You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Bob. You know, it's really great to be on the show because one of the curious things about being a JFK historian these days is you get a lot more calls from conservative and right-wing outlets than you do from liberal outlets. So most of the time I'm talking to people who are not, you know, in tune with me, you know, and so I feel I'm in tune with you generally on things. So it's I'm glad to come home, so to speak.
Glad to have you here. You know, I guess there just aren't enough left-wing conspiracy theorists out there. The, you know, and I want to say that's not, that shouldn't be a negative term. I mean, there are conspiracies, and if you have a theory about one, you may be right. And this is what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, no, you know what I like, because I think that conspiracy language has been politicized. You know, the Warren Commission skeptics, you know, that's a better term for the, you know, the JFK research community. We are Warren Commission skeptics. We're not, you know, most of us, like me, or a lot of us, don't have a particular theory of how the whole thing unfolded, you know? Mm-hmm. So we don't have a conspiracy theory, but we are definitely, the thing that unifies everybody, I think, is the term Warren Commission skeptic.
Yeah. So let me set the stage. For starters, let me tell people, you're Jefferson Morley. I'm Robert Wright. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're a journalist with considerable experience among the places you've been on staff of the Washington Post, the New Republic. You're the author of a book, The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. Remember that name, folks. It's going to come up later in the conversation because I think you think that the recently released JFK documents add at least some corroboration to the theory that Angleton himself may have been involved in a conspiracy to assassinate JFK. We'll come to that.
Yeah.
Anyway, you are one of the most accomplished and best known researchers of the assassination. In fact, you'll be testifying before a congressional committee, I think on Monday.
Tuesday.
Okay. And that was the committee hearing was occasioned, of course, by the recent release of these JFK documents. And that's what we're going to talk about. Now the documents have been received in some mainstream media corners with something close to a yawn. And I think you're going to...
It's easy to yawn when you haven't read 90% of the material.
And there's no, you would agree, it's not like there's a smoking gun. I mean, first of all, there was stuff released that's of interest kind of aside from the assassination. And then there's stuff that may be related to the assassination that people may think of as not related to the assassination. I mean, for example, we will get into this Schlesinger memo, which I think some people took as just kind of interesting in its own right. You would say is in some respects connected to the assassination.
It's interesting in its own right, but I mean, I want to be clear. There's a fact pattern here, a fact pattern of malfeasance. Now, that fact pattern has been there in the JFK story for a while, and it has grown stronger in the release, in the material released since 2017. These mainstream news media outlets assiduously avoid addressing or reporting on this new evidence. And I want to, there's a psychological kind of confirmation bias thing going on here that we need to talk about.
Okay. So let me set the stage a little again with the idea in mind that much of my audience is not that steeped in this. Now, I was not at all steeped until the 60th anniversary of the assassination a couple years ago. I suddenly went down the rabbit hole for the first time. As you know, I don't know nearly as much as you know, but I know a lot more than I did before. In fact, as you may recall, I mentioned this in our last conversation when I was in Texas this fall. I finally went to Dealey Plaza, went to the JFK Museum, came back with, among other things, this copy of the Dallas Times Herald, published only hours. This is a facsimile copy. It's an interesting thing. You can leaf through it. The whole thing is there anyway. It's an interesting relic of the age. That was published only hours after Kennedy died. And I want to say one thing before I want to present the broad outlines of the theory that elements of the national security establishment, including elements of the CIA, may have been involved in a conspiracy. Just the broadest outlines in very short form. And then I'm going to have you tell me what I got wrong, elaborate on that, and then we'll get into what these new documents add. Go ahead.
I think of it not as a theory, but as an interpretation. A theory makes it sound like it's something ginned up out of nowhere. This is a historical debate, and we're talking about one interpretation of what the new evidence tells us.
Okay.
Okay.
And I would also say, by the way, until you've been down the rabbit hole, just for at least a little while, as I went, you know, and I should say my position now is, I would say there's a more than 50% chance that there was at least someone else involved in this. Okay, I could elaborate, but I'm pretty agnostic about most of it. But the Warren Commission story, I agree. That's the commission assembled by LBJ right after it to investigate. I agree, we got problems with that narrative. But what I want to say is, until you've been down the rabbit hole, it's hard to appreciate how many little things there are, little piece of evidence connecting the CIA to the assassination story and the Oswald story. And so that's the thing that you were immersed in already. Mm-hmm. And people, you know, have to take these additional documents as kind of additional data points to something that already is suggestive. So let me paint the broad, whatever you want to call this thing, that existed before the documents came out. This idea that maybe elements of the CIA and maybe more broadly the national security establishment were involved. Okay, for starters, a lot of tension between JFK and the CIA, especially after the Bay of Pigs. So Bay of Pigs, this covert op hatched during the Eisenhower administration by the CIA. The idea was these Cuban exiles are going to like invade Cuba. We're going to give them support. They're going to do regime change. Then no more Castro. The operation goes awry. It's not working out from the beginning. CIA says to JFK, hey, listen, it looks like we're going to need you to just go overt about this thing. We need some actual military forces. Can we have those? He says, no, look, you told me this is going to work without us sending American pilots over it and bombers. No way. In the wake of this, it was such a fiasco. Kennedy fires the head of the CIA, Allen Dulles, a little bit later. There was a little bit of a decent interval. But anyway, a lot of tension between him and the CIA. More broadly within the national security establishment, there were concerns that Kennedy was just not tough enough on communism, wasn't tough enough on Castro. And if you aren't old enough to have been alive during the Cold War, I want to emphasize how hot the passions ran, and certainly including within the national security establishment, and how intensely people felt about this. And there's one little thing I want to say to illustrate that is, some people would say, relevant to the assassination, but there was this Operation Northwoods thing. This was approved by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, all the military brass, including the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. The idea was to stage a false flag attack on an American target, blame it on Cuba, and therefore justify war with Cuba. Now, Jeff, was that in the plan itself, was that going to be on Cuban soil? An American target on Cuban soil or on American soil?
On American soil, definitely.
It was. Okay, so in the plan. So that, you know, if that strikes you as crazy the way it strikes me, I just want to say that's the kind of times they lived in, okay? This is what people in the Pentagon wanted to do. They sent this to Kennedy. He said, get out of here. No. And then they felt so strongly that they waited a while and approved it again a year. And months before his assassination, they put it on his desk again. These guys were serious. They wanted to stage a false flag attack on American soil. And in addition to this being kind of a gauge of the sentiment of the time, Jeff, you would have pointed out, look, if you look at what finally happened, the Kennedy assassination, it has some things in common with the Northwood plan itself, which is to say, attack on an American target. It was blamed immediately on this pro-Castro guy, Oswald. I mean, he was said to be pro-Castro. And And it was immediately people started saying, we got to go to war with Cuba. I just want to say one more thing before I let you correct and add whatever, which is that I said there are just all kinds of connections between the CIA and this thing that are suggestive. Okay. So one of these is, if you ask, well, what so far as we know, was the first group to like within hours of Oswald's apprehension, get in touch with American media outlets and start saying, do you realize this guy's got a pro-Cuba past? It was an organization. It was an anti-Castro organization funded by the CIA. And if you ask what evidence could they point to that had been accumulated before the assassination, that Oswald was in fact a pro-Castro activist, I think they had been involved in that too, right? In New Orleans, so when Oswald was in New Orleans, not long, but before the assassination, I guess months before or something,
three months before,
he was confronted on the sidewalk by the same group, right? And that created this big thing that got coverage in the newspapers. So this group puts it on the record that he's pro-Castro.
Right.
Immediately after the assassination, calls media organizations, and this group is being funded by the CIA. So I just want to say there's a lot of little stuff. Now, I know I've talked a long time, but I'm just mindful of a diverse audience with diverse degrees of awareness of this. So go ahead.
You are focusing absolutely in on, this is one of the key stories that has emerged since Oliver Stone's movie, Operation North Woods, which was discovered by the Assassination Records Review Board in 1997. Okay, so 5 years after Stone made his movie, it turns out that this kind of conspiratorial mindset, anti-democratic mindset, we need to trick the people into a war with Cuba, how pervasive that was in the upper echelon of the U.S. military. So that's one thing. Now, the people today who are saying there's nothing in these files, those people will also tell you, pay no attention to this North Woods business. When it came out, they said, not important. Pay no attention to it. Most people, once they read Operation North Woods, understand that these mainstream media reporters are really off base. It's an incredibly interesting story that this is the stance of the Pentagon in the summer of 1963 when these CIA-funded assets are doing what the CIA paid them to do. You know, we have the records of that group. The Cuban Student Directorate was funded by the CIA under a secret program called AMSPEL. That program was run by an undercover officer in Miami named George Joannides. So, that's very well documented. And what they paid them for was political action and propaganda. And when they ran into this unknown character named Oswald, guess what? They engaged in political action and generated propaganda. Now, some people say, like the Warren Commission defenders, that's just a coincidence. Oswald was a crazy guy and he ran into these Cubans and he acted in a crazy way, so pay no attention to it. You know, to me, it looks like a CIA operation is going on. You know, and the fact that the CIA has no explanation of these events, if you go and ask them, could you produce your files on these events, the AMSPEL program, they'll say, we've complied with the law. You know, they don't want to talk about it. They don't have an explanation of it. So what we're getting from the new files is this, new clarity about things like Northwoods. Now, one point about the Northwoods documents. The Northwoods documents are, which were found in 1997, it's a Pentagon plan. It does reflect a profound division between the Pentagon and President Kennedy. And even the official history of the Joint Chiefs of Staff says that after the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 1963, relations between the president and the Joint Chiefs were at an all-time low. Okay? They are very alienated from each other. So we have the revelation post-Oliver Stone about Operation North Woods taking place in the context of this profound split between JFK and the Pentagon. You know, it's a big deal. It's that when this was discovered. Now, we were told that it wasn't. There's about 200 pages in the Northwoods plans that were released. And in those 200 pages, there's a couple of pages that are totally redacted. So when I put in to the Trump people, and said, you guys should release this document. It comes back with those same black redactions in it. And it turns out that the government itself does not have an unredacted copy of the Northwoods plans. There's a couple of pages missing from it. Is that a smoking gun? No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying the historical record of the assassination is incomplete as a result. So the Northwoods is important. A couple of other things, you know, you talk about this, you know, there's some doubt. People should remember too, you know, these doubts were shared at the highest levels of the U.S. government. Okay. President Johnson told an aide in 1967 who told somebody at the FBI that he thought the CIA was involved in Kennedy's assassination. Johnson never believed the conclusion of the Warren Commission. On three different occasions, he said that he did not believe that Oswald had acted alone. You know, which makes me ask the question to the defenders of the Warren Commission. If the man who appointed the commission didn't believe in its conclusion, why should I?
Right. I mean, he was happy to have that conclusion out there, right? But for political purposes, that was right. He didn't want to get drawn into a war. He didn't want to get blamed himself. After all, he was from Texas and benefited from the assassination. All kinds of reasons that...
Yes, but people should know one more thing, Bob, too. Yes, he got the conclusion that he wanted, that guy did it, mm-hmm. and we don't have anything else to worry about. But he reached that conclusion within 48 hours of the assassination. He didn't wait for there to be any investigation of this conveniently dead man, Oswald. When Oswald was dead, Johnson immediately turned to Assistant Deputy Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach and said, mm-hmm. we have to convince the public that he's the only assassin. So the president hasn't been buried. The investigation of his murder has barely begun. And the president has the answer. And he got it, you know, 10 months later from the Warren Commission, got the answer he wanted. Since then, we've learned, you know, how hasty a conclusion that was.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about how some of the documents bear on James Jesus Angleton, the guy you wrote a whole book about called The Ghost. He was the head of counterintelligence for the CIA. And by the way, throughout this, I'll do my best to be devil's advocate, give you pushback. Enough time, I'm gonna aggressively interrogate your position that maybe Oswald wasn't involved in the shooting per se at all. And I also want to bring a point that you might cite in defending the Warren Commission that occurred to me, and I want to bring that in the end. So anyway. I'll do my best to make this as balanced as possible, even though I do think Oswald did not act alone. I mean, he may have been the only shooter. I think that's not implausible, but I don't think he was alone in the operation. Okay, so this guy, fascinating character, Angleton, and he, you tell us what we knew before and what we knew now. We knew, for example, the CIA was reading Oswald's mail very early on, but some new stuff came out about that, right?
Right. So in the JFK files that were still secret, we have some visibility and we can understand what was there and what was redacted. So before the latest release, there were 13 documents in the National Archives JFK collection about James Angleton that contained redactions, okay? Mm-hmm. All of those have been declassified now. Most of them were declassified last week on March 18th. So that's the first time we've seen these Angleton documents in their totality. Why are they important, okay? They don't involve the crime scene. The most important one is from 1958. So they helped set the scene. They helped describe how this unknown man named Oswald came to be of such interest to Angleton, the premier counterintelligence officer in the Western world, okay? Mm-hmm. A man often, usually, typically described as a pathetic loser worthy of no interest is in fact a man of abiding interest to one of the top men in the CIA. Who was James Angleton? Just for people who are, you know, not that familiar with the story, James Angleton was a CIA officer, joined the agency after the war at its founding, and in 1954 became the chief of counterintelligence. Counterintelligence is the defensive aspect of intelligence work, right? You know, you're doing espionage, covert action, you're attacking the enemy. Counterintelligence, you're trying to stop the other guy from doing that stuff to you. Dirty tricks, covert operations, assassinations, you know. So counterintelligence is what Angleton specialized in, and he held that position for the next 20 years. My book, The Ghost, is about how he turned that position, utterly unknown to most of Washington and most of the world, into a real position of power to effectively run a CIA within a CIA. So the Angleton documents that have emerged in the past week tell us about this man who had this extraordinary power, and a couple of things in particular about his handling of this guy, Oswald. So first of all, the first revelation, the first kind of positive nugget, you called it, that we learned from these documents. Angleton considered recruiting Oswald as an agent, as a source or contact. How do we know that? Because an FBI memo from 1958 was declassified. And in it, an FBI official reports to his boss that they've stumbled across this massive CIA covert operation being run out of the post office at LaGuardia Airport in New York. And so they go and they ask at the CIA and they get a meeting with Angleton, who says, look, here's what's going on. We're running this mail intercept program, mail coverage, they called it chastely. We're running a mail coverage program. And what was top secret until last week was how big it was. Had a budget of $1 million a year, which would be, in today's dollars, probably
tens of millions,
$10 or $12 million. Yeah. And involved a couple hundred people. And even if you factor in a little bureaucratic boasting and that sort of thing, this is a big operation. And we knew that Angleton was running this operation, but the CIA was keeping secret just how big it was. The other thing that the CIA didn't release was, in talking to the FBI, Angleton knows this is quite sensitive, right? Because they're reading the mail of Americans without probable cause, without authorization. The president doesn't know anything about it. They basically got strong-armed the postmaster general into saying yes. So the FBI and the CIA know that this is basically an illicit thing. And so Angleton assures them, I'm not spying on Americans. He says the sole purpose of putting somebody under mail coverage is so that we can approach them, somebody who's living behind the Iron Curtain, who has contacts in the U.S., and we can approach them to be a source or a contact. That's in January 1958. Angleton's explaining, why does he put mail coverage on somebody? 22 months later, Oswald goes to the Soviet Union, and Angleton puts mail coverage on him. Okay, he decides, we're going to intercept the mail of these guys. Now, Angleton did have other reasons to put people under mail coverage. You know, people whose political views he didn't like, liberals and leftists. Mm-hmm. So he did that. But Oswald is a 20-year-old Marine Corps washout who has no visible public views. So that's not why Angleton put him on the list. Because he was a defector, that's probably a motivation too. But as Angleton himself said, the reason, and he said the sole reason, was to identify people to be a source or a contact. Okay,
an asset in some sense.
Yes, an asset in some sense. Okay, so we didn't know that before. Okay, and now we know it. So, he at least thought about it. Okay, that had to be in his mind when he put Oswald on that list. Now, there's nothing in the CIA's pre-assassination Oswald file, which indicates that he ever was approached or used as an agent. Okay, now, that kind of information typically wouldn't be in a CIA file. So the fact that it's not there doesn't mean that he wasn't an agent, but we don't have any evidence of it. In the same regard, there's no evidence in the file that anybody said, this guy's a pathetic loser, there's no reason to pay attention to him. To the contrary, and this is something that we've learned in recent years, Angleton and his people pay close attention to Oswald for the next 4 years. And in fact, here's a remarkable statistic. There was no time between 1959 and November 1963 that the CIA did not have Lee Harvey Oswald's home address in their files. Mm-hmm. When he lived in Minsk, they had his address. When he came back to Fort Worth, they had his address. When he moved to New Orleans, they had his address. When he came back to Mexico City, he was under surveillance. So they knew where he was pretty much all the way until he gets to Dallas, 6 weeks before the assassination.
And after he moved to Texas, a CIA asset, I guess you would call them, named George de Morenschild, befriended Oswald, and it seems pretty clear that he was, we don't know exactly how the communication was working, but he was in touch with CIA people and made a point of being in touch with Oswald.
George de Morenschild was an oil engineer on good terms with a man named Jim Moore, who was the head of the CIA office in Dallas. And de Morenschild said that he talked to Moore about Oswald. De Morenschild wanted to talk to him because de Morenschild was Russian, and he learned that there was this guy with a Russian wife, and so he wanted to meet him. You know, he thought he would be an interesting person. So he asked Moore, should I talk to this guy? And Moore said, that's fine, you know, go ahead. So both Moore knew that Oswald was in Dallas, and George de Morenschild, who was very friendly with CIA people, was friends with Oswald.
Yeah. And de Morenschild, I don't want to get too far into it, but he recounts at one point that he conveyed things he knew about Oswald, notably, you know, the evidence that Oswald had tried to shoot this other guy before Kennedy. We won't get into that, but he says that he told, I don't know whether he says he told CIA, other government people, whatever, about that.
He talked about it with his friends. There's no evidence that he told the CIA about it.
But there was that line, we talked about this last time, where he says, that was my big mistake.
Yeah.
In reporting back about that thing. Well, anyway, so so Angleton, there's one other little thing that I think came up now, or was it before, about Angleton, this guy, the specific guy who was reading Oswald's mail, his last name was Efron or something.
Ruben Efron. Yeah, this is one of the important revelations of recent years.
Okay, so he's, and then there was...
So just to follow that point. So Angleton, it's pretty clear, considered recruiting Oswald as a possible source. Whether he did or not, we'll leave that aside. But the man who was reading Oswald's mail, Ruben Efron, we didn't learn his name until July 2023, 60 years after the fact. His name became public. And that was when that redaction was removed. It was only then, in June of 2023, that the CIA's pre-assassination file on Lee Harvey Oswald, the information that they gathered while President Kennedy was alive, that was not fully declassified for 61 years until the summer of 2023, when the New York Times reported that it was Ruben Efron, this man who, an operations officer working for Angleton, was the man who had been reading Oswald's mail for a year and a half while Kennedy was president.
And is there recent evidence that there's something about Angleton recruiting Soviet immigrants or something.
Yeah. And this is the second thing. This is the second thing to come out of the files that were released last week. I talked about 13 files that have been declassified. The one that was the most heavily redacted, and I would say probably of most interest to JFK researchers and historians, was Angleton's testimony to the Church Committee in June 1975. The Church Committee had been formed in the wake of the Watergate scandal, reports of CIA abuses of power, plots to assassinate foreign leaders, and kind of the backlash against Nixon and secret government. The Senate launches a very serious effort to investigate the intelligence community. And that was called the Church Committee after Senator Frank Church, the chairman. So with the CIA, you know, with its reputation in tatters, once the heroes of the Cold War, now they're perceived even by Americans as enemies, collaborating in the Watergate burglary and stuff like that. And so the Senate starts hauling these people, the former CIA officials, before to explain themselves. Well, Angleton comes and he's spoiling for a fight because he thinks he didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. And so they go and they get behind closed doors and the doors close and the senators say, you know, they swear Angleton in. And Senator Howard Baker says very delicately, you know, I hope that we can discuss the Oswald situation. I love that phrase, the Oswald situation. And Angleton immediately launches into a long, detailed summary of his career, explaining why he was so effective. And he wants to make the point, I was a very effective. And what he does is he explains his relationship with the Israeli intelligence services. And this document, 113-page transcript, which until last week, about there were redactions on about 40 of the 112 pages, is now fully available. And what Angleton was saying, what we weren't, you know, privy to before, was how Angleton developed his relationship with the Israelis. And in particular, he emphasized the connection was very important because the Israelis had access to Jewish emigrants from the Soviet Union. So these were people who had lived in the Soviet Union and could provide information about daily life there, about institutions, even about, you know, government and possibly things like that. So Angleton wanted to tap that. And he said, you know, we've gotten tremendous intelligence from this particular channel. And he said, and in fact, it was so successful that I took some of these Jewish immigrants, and he doesn't mention names, he says, and I incorporated them with some training into various operations. And they would go back and forth from the National Security Council to Tel Aviv. And these are the details that were secret until last week, that the word Tel Aviv was blocked out. So we didn't know. So that was, and he, and Angleton says, this was one of the most economical programs we ever had. And, you know, I probably placed like 10 people here. Well, Reuben Efron, the man who was reading Oswald's mail, fits that profile exactly. He was an emigre from the Soviet Union. Now, was Angleton using these foreign agents to monitor Oswald? I mean, a month ago, I would have said that was crazy. Now, with this, you know, fully Angleton's intelligence collection network fully laid bare, you know, I don't think you can, you know, erase the possibility.
And at any rate, we know of at least one guy, Efron, who we know read some of Oswald's mail. Sounds like he was one of these emigres, probably.
After he retired from the CIA, he moved back to Israel and lived there for a long time. And this, Bob, so this leads to what I think is the third revelation. And I'm going to report this on JFK Facts. And I think this is the most significant.
So we should say JFK Facts is both your podcast and your newsletter. Yeah.
Yes. JFK, moment of hype or advertising, JFK Facts on Substack. jfkfacts.substack.com. And yes, we do have a podcast every Thursday night at 8 o'clock, which people are invited to join in and listen. So the third thing that I think emerges from the files that I saw last week from the 13 declassified Angleton documents is Angleton's testimony to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978. And at that time, Angleton's still defending himself. He's in retirement. He's more of a bitter man and, you know, losing tremendous amount of power, being disgraced or humiliated, taking a toll on him. But he still wants to defend his name and answer all the questions. So he comes and he goes through 6 hours of interrogation. And at the end of the interrogation, under oath, Angleton is asked, was Lee Harvey Oswald ever the subject of a CIA project? And Angleton says, no. Okay, which was a lie. He knew that Angleton was on the mail. Oswald was on the mail surveillance list. He had put him there. The next question that Angleton is asked is, "Do you know a man named Reuben Efron?" Angleton says yes. What was his job? Angleton says mail intercept. So Angleton's second and third answers prove that his first answer was a lie. Okay, he did know that Oswald was the subject of a CIA project, a project that he himself ran. And he pretended like he didn't know that. Now, why would he do that? To protect a CIA operation and to protect all the other CIA operations that would converge on Oswald in 1963, which we have since learned about. So Angleton's lie about the surveillance of Oswald is designed to sustain the theory of the lone gunman, right? We didn't know anything about this guy. We weren't really paying attention to him. He just slipped by us. You know, that's just the way it is. It's the tragedy of life. That's the CIA's position, right? But now we see that that answer is a cover, and it's a cover for Oswald's abiding interest in this utterly unknown character named Lee Harvey Oswald.
So his denying that Oswald was the focus of a project only came to light through these this recent release of documents?
That's correct.
Mm. Well, that is interesting. I mean, he may have, who knows, he may have thought of some clever way of semantic sense
do.
In which... Yeah, right? He's like, well, the project per se, but obviously, if he was being truthful, he'd have to say... And, you know, even if he hadn't said at that point, I know that Efron was intercepting mail, it's a pretty fair bet that he knew, if he was in charge of the mail intercept operation, it's a pretty good bet that he knew that Oswald was
exactly.
a person of interest for years. Yeah. And so it is interesting that he denied that.
And so now, and let me just put that fact in perspective, okay? Yes, Angleton, I think it's clear. There's one conclusion. He lied about his about the surveillance of Oswald. He lied about the mail surveillance of Oswald. He mm-hmm. knew about it and he said he did. Okay? But Angleton's not the only senior CIA official to lie about their pre-assassination of Oswald. Okay? Angleton's deception now fits into a pattern of deception. Okay? And let me name the other two CIA officers who lied about what they knew about Oswald before the assassination. One of them was Angleton's great good friend, Dick Helms, Richard Helms, the deputy director of the CIA in 1963. When Helms was called before the Warren Commission in May 1964 to testify under oath behind closed doors, he was asked, well, do you think that you got sufficient information from the State Department about this guy Oswald? And Director John McCone and Richard Helms both answer the question. McCone says, we have very little information in our files about Oswald. And Helms says, in answer to the same question, how much information did you have? Helms says, it was probably minimal. Okay? That's what two CIA officials said under oath. Here's what we know now, Bob. At that time, before Kennedy was killed, Angleton had a dossier on Oswald that ran to more than 180 pages. We have that dossier now. It's been, you know, fully, slowly declassified over the years. You can't get it from the CIA. You can't find it on the internet. You can find it at JFK Facts because we do have it. And we are sharing it with people who are interested in the story and who take it seriously. So when McCone and Helms said that, did they know about the file? I mean, McCone, probably not. McCone was a corporate executive who Kennedy had brought in because he was a conservative Republican, and he didn't want a CIA guy running the CIA, which he didn't trust. He wanted his own guy who was an outsider, who would push back against the agency. Okay, so whether McCone deliberately lied, McCone might have been duped by the CIA. But Richard Helms was the deputy director of operations. He was Angleton's boss. If he didn't know about the 180-page file on Oswald, he should have known. He had the responsibility to know because Angleton reported to him, not to McCone. Okay, so I say Helms deliberately lied under oath. He knew when he said the information they had in their files was minimal. It was not minimal. It was maximal. So Helms lied under oath about the pre-assassination knowledge of Oswald. That Helms's deception echoed, Helms's deception in 1964 echoed 14 years later when Congress reopened the JFK investigation. Okay, Congress came to the CIA, started asking questions. We'd like to see some files. We'd like to talk to some people. We want to revisit this whole business about Oswald and the events of 1963. So the CIA calls out of retirement a covert action officer named George Joannides. Okay. He certainly knew the subject. He had been stationed in Miami in 1963, and it was his agents who had been all over Oswald. So when the House Select Committee investigators ask him, who was running this AMSPEL program? Who was in charge of these Cuban students in 1963? They asked this question to George Ioannidis, and he is the answer to their question, okay? And
he because he was doing it.
Yeah, he was doing it in 1963. And he tells them, I don't know, I'll get back to you, okay? Okay, so that's the equivalent of lying under oath. He had a professional obligation to tell them the truth, and he didn't.
And he was a designated CIA liaison to this committee, right? Like a guy who was knee deep, although I don't think you think he was involved in the assassination per se, necessarily, but
he's a material witness. He's a material witness.
But the guy designated, still, he was knee deep in what now looks in retrospect as if there was CIA involvement by some elements of the CIA, what looks as if it was part of that operation, you know, this Cuban group that.
Absolutely. But my point is, what do we know now that we didn't know before? Mm-hmm. Now we have three top CIA officials, not just officials, because that doesn't quite convey it. These are all officers. These are all men who were running operations. They weren't just, you know, presiding over some paper pushing over here. Helms, Angleton, and Ioannidis were all running covert operations in 1963. And all three of them are now known to have lied about what they knew about Oswald before the assassination. So when people from the mainstream media, you know, say there's nothing here, they just don't know anything about this. And what they're telling you is, we don't want to know. We don't want to talk about that new evidence. Please, you know. And so people like me who come forward and say, you know, here it is, they say, you know, it's nothing. You know, there's an essay in the New Yorker. It's bupkis. You know, it's well, you know, some people would say three top CIA officers lying about the surveillance of an assassin is bupkis. I say three top CIA officers lying about a presidential assassin is a big deal, and we should report it.
So one more question before we go into overtime. First of all, we should say not all the documents are out. You had, I think, some time ago identified the like about 15 documents you would most like to see released or unredacted or whatever needed doing. We still have not seen most of those, right? Well, we saw a few, but
not quite true, Bob. For the records that were in the JFK collection already, okay, these are records that were seen by the JFK Review Board in the 1990s. Agencies requested redactions. The redactions remained in place. And so we had identified, I think, 9 records that had what we call RIF numbers, record identification form. So it's a specific document from a specific day. There were, I think, 9 of those that we sought, and we have received 7 of those. Were declassified in full, including the Angleton, two Angleton documents. So, one Angleton document. So that was very good. That showed that the president's order was effective in accomplishing pretty broad strokes of detail. The problem, Bob, is with this JFK documents that were still in possession of the CIA that were never turned over to the JFK Review Board, never turned over to the National Archives. And in our request to the administration, we identified, I think, 7 documents like that, and we haven't received any of them.
Okay.
So that's where we, and the Ioannidis file is one that we have not received.
I have a question about what may be one of those documents. You tell me if it is. So this guy named William Harvey, who was in effect head of assassinations for the CIA. They had had this big program, try to assassinate Castro. He was running it. That put him in charge with these organized crime figures who may well figure into the assassination. Who knows? But he was very intense, apparently, Kennedy hater. And he had been kind of marginalized. He had been assigned and sent off to Rome because I guess he fell out of favor with, I don't know, the administration or somebody.
It was worse than that, Bob. At a very tense meeting at the White House in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Harvey turned to Robert Kennedy. Harvey's a big man, like 6'2", very fat, always carried a gun. and he leans into Robert Kennedy's face and he says, if you, and he screams, if you fuckers hadn't fucked up the Bay of Pigs, we wouldn't be in this fucking mess. At that moment, as John McCone said, or an aide to John McCone said, Bill Harvey lost all of his usefulness. And RFK told the CIA, get rid of this guy, get him out of Washington. We don't want to see him again.
Okay.
Harvey was sent to Rome.
So as of the assassination, he's a guy who does not like the Kennedys. And that's documented elsewhere. He's intense, maybe borderline wacky. But in any event, in David Talbot's book, I gather, I haven't read the book, but his book, The Devil's Chessboard, about Alan Dulles, he reports, maybe you can tell me the source, that Harvey, in early November of 63, the month of the assassination, Harvey flies to Dallas, or somebody reported, a source reported that Harvey was flying to Dallas. When asked what he was going to do there, he said, oh, just to look around. Now, he's flying from Rome, I guess. So you don't, it's not like your average weekend jaunt. I have two questions. Now, do you remember who the source, whether Talbot's source is anonymous or what? A and B.
No, it was a good source. It was a guy who worked in the U.S. Embassy in Italy. And so, which is where Harvey worked. And so
it's a named source saying that Harvey Mark told Wyatt, him, I'm just going to look around.
Yeah. Mark Wyatt was a State Department officer who told this story to other people. He's since died, but his family says that that's exactly what he said. And not only that, that Wyatt was very disturbed by Harvey's behavior. I mean, Harvey would routinely end an argument by pulling a gun, pointing it at somebody's head and saying, don't you agree with me? And so, you know, that was...
I hate people like that, Jeff. I'm going to go on record. To me, that just starts to call our friendship into question when people do that to me.
Yeah, I mean, it really makes things difficult, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the records that we asked for, when David wrote that book, or after he wrote the book, he filed a lawsuit, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, and he said he wanted any records of travel records of Harvey in 1963. And the CIA came back and said, we will neither confirm nor deny the existence of such records, okay? Which is what they say when they have records. So so we put that request into to the administration as well, Bill Harvey travel records, and those have not appeared. I should say too, one more thing, Bob, and this is another news story that I'm going to publish soon. The CIA has produced no records in response to President Trump's executive order. Mm. We know that they have a lot of records that may be relevant. They should certainly go look. If they couldn't find the Bill Harvey records before, they should go look again. They have not done so. I talked to a senior archives official yesterday who told me they have received no JFK records since Trump's order except from the FBI.
And I would just say, if it turns out that these records exist and they do show that he flew from Rome to Dallas in November 63, a couple of weeks before November, before the assassination, we've already got a credible person saying he refused to get specific about what he was going to do there. Given everything we know about this guy, I would call that a very strong piece of circumstantial evidence. I mean, that would be big.
Yeah, no, and that's why David Talbot sued for it, because he recognized when he told that story, and I talked to him about it after the book. I said, I'd never heard that story. I thought it was an amazing story. And, you know, like, wow, can we find out more? Once again, a reporter got stiffed by the CIA. But the point being, Trump's executive order, 14176, is quite mm-hmm. clear about the need for full and complete JFK disclosure. So, if they do have those records, they now have to produce them. This neither confirm nor deny stance, that's defiance of Trump's order.
Okay, well, we will see. So, as I said, we're going to go into overtime. That's a part of the conversation that's available to paid subscribers to the Non-Zero newsletter. I encourage everyone to become one and support non-mainstream content.
Yes.
Like this. You can click on the link in the show notes, go to Non-Zero, You can sign up for the special podcast feed. So forevermore, you'll have access to this stuff. Plus, there's a lot of print bonus content. Anyway, thanks. I should also say, Jeff's newsletter, JFK Facts. You can become a paid subscriber to that too, if you would like, or a regular subscriber. And the book is The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton. So I'm going to, when we get into overtime, I do have this, this theory that I've never heard trotted out in defense of, it's not in defense of the Warren Commission, per se, but it's a way you could reconcile the existing evidence, with there only being one shooter without resorting to the single bullet theory. I'll say that it's maybe crazy. And then maybe I'll also ask you for, I also want to get a little into the Schlesinger memo and a little more into Angleton. So thanks to everybody and hope to see you in overtime.